Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. A big Friday welcome to Books and Arts here on RN, where it's all about colour and movement today. This is the music ensemble Decibel. Now, they don't play from a traditional score. Just listen to this and see what you can visualise. What's happening here? Lots of shapes, lots of colours. These people don't create their music in response to coloured circles, in response to a score, I mean. They look at circles and cubes and quotes and pictures, and they call this system animated notation.
Well, there's actually a lot of parameters in traditional notation that we apply to this imagery or this animated notation. And they're things like the higher up in the image it is, the higher up it is in pitch. The darker the colour, the more dense the sound is. These are things that actually as musicians we're trained in traditional notation to, you know, intuit almost. And so they become very important in graphic notation.
See, that makes perfect sense to me. The other day I was driving along and I saw Birds on a Wire and I thought I could sing that tune. I sang it to my wife. I don't know that she was that impressed. The Brisbane Festival opens tomorrow. The program is jumping with colour and movement. Sarah Konofsky previews the lineup. That's later on. But first, we open ourselves to the calming joys of colouring in.
Linger on. Your pale blue eyes.
Now, I've spent the morning before we started the show colouring in. I've been colouring in a picture of New York. There's a taxi in the front and there's a building, which I've done some quite nice work on there. And the idea is that this is supposed to calm me down. It's not just fun. It ends the stressful life that we all live in. It brings some calm to it all. Now, one proponent of this idea is Dr. Stan Rodsky, who's a neuroscientist and is the author of several adult colouring in books. And he joins us right now. Good morning.
Good morning. Colouring books for adults.
Colouring books for adults.
It can be misinterpreted the other way.
Oh, I see. Yes, for adults. I've got you. Yes. Yes, they're not picture. They're not full of saucy images. They're full of patterns and shapes. And I've got one here with pictures in it. Anyway, we'll talk about the relative merits of each kind in a minute. Now, look, I'd love to hear from you. If you're a devotee of colouring in books, you can text us on 0418 22 65 76. If you're in the eastern seaboard area in eastern state. You can tweet us at RN Books and Arts, or you can comment on our Facebook page anytime and comment on our website as well. Wherever you're listening, if you're podcasting or listening in the west or in the centre, jump onto the website and have your say about this. If you've been colouring in and you found it calming, you found it beneficial, or perhaps you think it's a lot of tosh, tell us either way. Now, Stan, you've worked for a psychologist, worked as a psychologist for over 30 years. When did you first hear of this idea?
Look, the idea really popped into my head struggling with executives, managers, people that would normally be referred to me with stress, who just found it incredibly difficult to ever do deep breathing or relaxation or meditation. They would start and they would stop. But then really watching children and the way that they relax while colouring really prompted the thought, you know, why can't adults re-enter that state in a brain state? Because that's what we're trying to do in meditation as well. We're trying to relax for a minute, go offline, go off the computer-based digital world we're in.
So do you think we need different kinds of images, though, from kids? Presumably a seal with a ball balanced on its nose or a wacky clown falling over. Maybe that's not the thing to calm your stressed exec.
No, look, and I agree. You only have to be with your kids colouring for a little while and the kids want to go and do something else. You're left there still doing it and you're wondering, why am I enjoying this? This is Donald Duck's leg I'm finishing off here. But the reality is indeed. But the reality here is that we actually enjoy the process.
Right.
Because it's a process that takes us to a time when we were stress-free.
Now, is there good you're a neuroscientist. Yes. Is there good science behind this?
Look, there is, because when we started looking at this about 3 years ago, we now have technologies like EEG, ECG. These are measurements of brain waves, heart rhythms, etc., which allow us to see just what the impact of certain things you do have on the brain and its reactions. And the most amazing things occurred. We started seeing changes in heart rate, changes in brain wave, changes just in the way the brain relaxes itself going offline into a task like this.
And EEG stands for?
That's really around the heartbeat measurement, whereas the ECG is around the brainwave measurement.
Do we know what these letters stand for?
Encephalograms, yes, cardiograms,
yes,
are the two. They're long-winded names.
Right. I was thinking of MCG, but of course that's a sports venue.
Okay.
So there are actually studies. This isn't just based on your observation that it seems to calm people down.
No, we've actually been measuring this.
Now, I've noticed in one of the publications of yours that I've looked at that you think the choice of colours is revealing. I'm a bit sceptical about this. How does this work?
There's a lot of research here.
Okay, all right. Well, my scepticism may fall over, but let me air it anyway.
Yes.
So you show me a pattern. I mean, let's do it now. So you show me a design.
Yes.
So I've got, here's your latest book.
Yes.
And, okay, so I've got an abstract design in front of me.
Yes.
Oh. And then the question is, you've got a bunch of pencils, so I've got my own pencils here.
Yes. If you go to the front of the book, you can see the colour choices.
Okay. So suppose I choose, I quite like green. So I choose a light green, and I'm going to start colouring in light green. And here I am just colouring away in light green.
Okay.
Now, what does the fact that I chose light green tell you?
Well, the light green is really, in terms of the hues of the colours, they're telling us there's some mixed emotions in there with you. Is that what
it says? Unsettled, cool, mixed emotions.
Yes.
Is that bad?
No, it's not necessarily bad. Look, go to the ends of the spectrum for a moment to understand it. If someone is feeling low and a little bit depressed, maybe, or just flat, you'll tend to see colours like blacks, greys, those types of colours. If you look at someone who's at the other end of the spectrum and quite fired up, you find the colours like reds, etc. The reason being that why do we associate red with stop?
I don't know. Why?
Well, there's a very strong, impelling argument around fire, heat,
blood,
those sorts of things tend to be something based in our psychological brain makeup to instinctually put us in one direction or another. And there's been a lot of research around, and they're the hues of them. So colour choice in our second book is really about maybe if I'm feeling a little blue.
Right.
maybe I need to sort of dilute, and I may be choosing colours that in a normal colouring book, well, the sea's got to be blue, doesn't it? But if I'm in a book which is more around shapes and patterns, which is what we're about, shapes, the patterns, the repetition, the detail, that's what the brain loves.
Right.
If you can actually infiltrate that with some colour.
I'm so sceptical about this because I know that when I choose a colour, it's to do with what I've already done. You see, I'm thinking what would look good alongside that. I don't think I'm expressing my inner psychic state. I think, okay, what do I want? I've just done yellow. I put some blue alongside that.
But where did that thought come from? The research is certainly there, and it's not definitive by any stretch of the imagination just yet.
Let's hear from Pam, who's a listener. She's on the line.
Yes.
Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Now, how did you get hooked into colouring in?
We actually went away for a weekend and I went into a bookshop and saw a book and went and laughed at my partner and said, I can't believe that they're actually, you can buy books for adults to colour in. And by the time we'd driven home, I'm going up to the shops. I really think I like the idea of doing this. And I've had a lot of fun. So I'm a bit worried now about what colours I'm colouring in.
Yeah, that's right. I know. I've become so introspective and troubled by. Stan had me so calm at the start, and now he's got me introspective about whether I've done the right thing by choosing green. But
I wouldn't show him if I were you.
No, we won't reveal our colours.
And I won't be colouring in with black.
No, steer clear of the black. So basically, this is a story of being transformed in the time it takes to get home from the shops.
Exactly. Oh, no. We were a couple of hours away.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But it was just, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, that sounds lovely. It doesn't take anything. I don't have to worry about whether my iPad's charged up or anything like that. I just sit down with my colouring in pencils and my book and I go on my merry way. And
does it add to calm around the home? How does your partner take to the fact that you've become a colouring in person?
Well, he bought me another book the other day, so obviously he thinks it's working well.
He likes you as a colouring in person, obviously, Pam.
Yes, more than he did with me playing other games on my iPad, but anyway.
Oh, well, that's a big endorsement. Thanks for joining us, Pam.
No problem. Thank you very much.
This is Books and Arts on RN, and we're exploring the fad that's around at the moment, the enthusiasm for adult colouring in. I don't know if you've heard about this, but there are so many books on the market that you can get full of patterns that you can colour in. Some are patterns and some actually have pictures. I've got a book here actually full of street scenes, famous scenes from all over the world. Now, Stan, I get the impression that you're not a fan of the books that actually have pictures in them. You'd rather we coloured in at more abstract designs, would you?
Well, I wouldn't say it's around being necessarily a fan or not. It's just that I position the books around helping adults to relax, and I find that a lot of adults that I've come across do get quite upset with themselves about the way they've coloured things. In other words, they create almost an internalised competition with themselves, which is the very thing we don't want to do.
Right.
Gee, does my yellow cab look like a yellow cab? Is it the right yellow? Is the background now good? And we can suddenly find ourselves caught up in that sort of competitive stance. But for many others, they just enjoy the colouring,
yeah,
which I think is marvellous.
I don't feel competitive about colouring in this picture of New York, though. Mm. I've actually enjoyed getting the yellow right. I haven't felt competitive. That makes me sound like a nasty person. Karen has commented on our Facebook page. She says she recently started doing this in bed before going to sleep, and she finds it lovely, mindful and soothing. So there you are. If you're listening, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. If you're one of the many people who join us in the wee small hours, maybe getting a colouring book and colouring away while you're listening to the radio, that might help you go to sleep.
It does work.
There you go.
It does work.
Our listenership might drop off in the evening because everyone's now colouring and falling asleep.
Well, thank goodness for that. Because your brain moves into an alpha wave. Which is very good. It's right now you and I are operating at about 30 cycles per second, which is a beta wave. An alpha wave is that step down when you just listen to your calming voice or listen to music or, you know, you have TV in the background or you meditate or you... these are called alpha waves. The brain needs alpha waves as its preparation for relaxing, preparation for sleep. So when you're colouring, you're actually deliberately changing the brain wave. It actually calms down.
Well, Daryl has texted and he says, I've been introduced to colouring as part of treatment for addiction. It is a mindful practice that helps reduce cravings. I was sceptical, but don't knock it till you try it. It's just one tool of many, but it really helps. Mm. So thanks, Daryl. That's a very affirming piece of feedback. Now, Mulga joins us. Mulga is a street artist, also known as Joel Moore, who's just released his first adult colouring in book. Mulga, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So you're an artist. Are you a fan of colouring in?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do for a job, so I love it.
What, you mean you draw an outline and then put in the colours?
Yeah, drawing pictures is pretty much colouring in, yeah.
Okay, and do you find it meditative? I mean, are you a calmer person? Have you noted this once you start working?
Yeah, definitely. So once you're doing the art or you're painting or colouring in, it's just you're kind of in the zone and you just kind of relax, listen to some music. It's probably the best part about it. Love it.
All right, so I'm looking at your colouring in book. You've called yours Mulga's Magical Colouring Book, and it's got a very sort of psychedelic elephant on the front.
Yeah.
So you've gone for a sort of grunge approach, I guess. Very sort of stylish pictures of faces and animals. What was guiding your choices as you put this book together?
So actually, a lot of these images are from my existing portfolio. So the way I do art is I put a lot of black outlines around the colours, so it's kind of worked out perfectly for a colouring in book. So I just kind of picked out all my choicest images that would be good for colouring in book, yeah, and put them together.
And what made you think that it would work as a book?
I guess colouring in books are all the rage at the moment, so putting out a colouring in book with cool images that are kind of, you know, bearded dudes or zombies or gorillas or, you know, animals, funkier stuff, kind of appeal to a younger audience. I think there's a bit of a different take on the colouring in book thing, so well, it's going to be different.
Who would pass up the chance to colour in a bearded dude?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, no, I've never done such a thing in my life, but, you know, you've opened my mind to it. Well, thanks, Mulgrew. It's good to hear from you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Good on you. Now, can I come back to this stand to look a little bit more carefully at this choice between the drawing and the more abstract shape or the abstract pattern? Talk to me about what you think happens when we colour in just pure shapes.
Sure. Look, a good analogy of it is on the nutrition side. The brain loves, for example, salt, sugar and fat. It McDonald's recipe, salt, sugar and fat, lights up the brain. On the cognitive side, the salt, sugar and fat are what I call repetition, pattern and detail. And if you can actually feed the brain, you know yourself, when you've got things that you can almost predict and they'll happen in a certain way and they happen within a time frame, it's quite relaxing for, you know, it's calming for us because we know where we are. And these designs were designed on that principle of repetition, pattern and detail.
That sounds like knitting. Would knitting have the same effect?
Well, knitting would have exactly the same effect except for one thing. It's a skill-based activity. In other words, you can pick up colouring pencils and you're back to where riding a bike again.
But when I see people everything. When I see people knitting on the train, they seem very calm. They're lost in their own little world.
They absolutely are, and it would be, I would recommend it, except for the fact that it's a skill that a lot of us have to get.
Yes.
And then once we learn, you know, how many of us know or are someone who started knitting and then halfway through that scarf it was never to be presented to anyone ever again in public?
We've got Megan Daly on the line, who's a book blogger, and she regularly talks about books on the evening show on ABC Local Radio in Brisbane. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
So you're a colouring in person as well?
Well, yeah, actually it's more my husband I've got into adult colouring in books. He's got a chronic pain condition and lives with a lot of pain. And about a year ago, he also loves hip-hop. And about a year ago, I bought him a colouring-in book of some of his favourite hip-hop artists as a bit of a joke. And he absolutely loved it, to the point that I would find him sitting with our two young children on the deck colouring for hours after they'd left the table. And I started researching I'm not quite going to call it an adult colouring book, the colouring book for adults. And I've now bought him some which are more pattern-based. And he does them every night and he finds them incredibly relaxing.
I was just thinking he might like Mulga's book of bearded dudes.
Oh, look, I am totally going to Google him straight away.
Not that we're endorsing any one product over another. We should hasten to add. So has it helped? I mean, you said he had a chronic pain issue. Has it helped control that?
Look, it's not taken his pain away, but it takes his mind off the pain for some level of time, and it calms him down at night. You know, he has great difficulty sleeping with chronic pain, and he had a tendency to be on his phone all the time or on a screen, as a lot of us do, and the colouring in books have really taken him offline, and I think he finds the repetitive nature of it really calming. I think he likes the patterns. Like you were talking about the colour, I'm going to look at what colours he uses now. But, yeah, I've gone on to buy them for quite a lot of my friends and also my dad, who's an academic, and I think his brain needs quite a lot of calming down.
You're calming dad down. Okay, Megan, you're spreading calm around the planet. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
No worries.
Good on you. And Maria's commented on her Facebook. She says, I also noticed the calming effect that this has had on dementia patients, particularly in the afternoon. So lots of endorsement there, Stan, for your overall thesis.
Yeah, look, again, the only place that we've done the rigorous work is the calming effect. Its subsequent effects are really interesting, you know, where people are taking this. One of the really interesting big areas in which the book's been adopted is in waiting rooms. You know, when you're waiting for your loved one, someone who's in hospital, they're sick, you're waiting, they just find this an amazingly calming process. After you've finished all the magazines, what am I now going to do? I'm still sitting. And they do find it calming. And that's what I'm basically saying here. That's where it is.
So there you are. If you're running an inefficient office and you're keeping your customers waiting, give them something to colour in.
Well, I was with a principal the other day and he said, you know, I'm going to use these with kids before they come in and see me.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
No, that's a good idea.
Mm.
Stan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Stan Rodsky. His forthcoming book is called Anti-Stress, a Colouring Book for Adults. It's published by Hardy Grant Books. It'll be in the bookshops in about 10 days' time. And Joel Moore's book is called Mulga's Magical Colouring In Book. It's published by Hachette, but there's lots of these books on the market. You'll find lots of them out there. And it's been lovely hearing from you. Do keep the conversation going. You can head to our website. You can comment there. And you can always chat away on Facebook or on Twitter. This is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart here on RN. Still to come, the band who make music by playing what they see in pictures. The Brisbane Festival opens tomorrow night, and over the next month there'll be more than 500 shows with performers coming to Brisbane from five continents. And there's a special focus this festival on two very different countries, the Democratic Republic of Congo and Singapore. The Brisbane Festival's artistic director is David Berthold, and he joins Sarah Konoski in our Brisbane studios. Sarah.
Thanks, Michael. And I've also got with me the Congolese countertenor Serge Kakuji and Belgian theatre maker Alain Platel, because it was their show, Coup Fatal, that you just heard the music to. In fact, there was a bit of dancing happening here in the studio. It's going to make its Australian premiere when the festival opens tomorrow night. But welcome all of you to Books and Arts.
Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
David, it's a big opening weekend for the Brisbane Festival. What could we go and see tomorrow?
Well, Coup Fatal is here at QPAC, and there's a piece in the concert hall called Rise for the Oceans, which is really a celebration of the sea that surrounds this continent, with Tim Winton and Bernard Fanning and Katie Noonan and William Barton, Jessica Watson, extraordinary list of great Australians.
Is that a show that's been put together for this festival?
Specifically for this festival, for just one performance.
And what else? Because from the ABC studios, we've got a sort of bird's eye view out over this little universe of Brisbane Festival that's starting to appear.
Our festival hub, if you like, Festival Central, is just out here by the river in front of QPAC, and it's about four times bigger than it normally is. And people have been used to one Spiegel tent, but there are two tents here this year, and I think about five bars and all sorts of free entertainment that can happen in the place. And it's so particularly alive and different this year that we felt that it needed a new name, so we've called it Arcadia.
It's a high there's something for us all to live up to, Arcadia.
Absolutely. It's an ideal place, and I hope it'll be an ideal place for people to come in the festival.
Because I guess that's one of the challenges in creating a festival that moves beyond the parameters of any individual concert hall or performance venue. I think that those great festivals are the ones that spill out onto the streets and into a city as a whole.
Absolutely. We're in about 20 different venues across the city, and you know, this is multi-arts, this is theatre, music, dance, cabaret, circus, and very often a mix of all of those things together, and from, I think, about 12 different countries this year. So, yes, we hope, I know, it'll really excite the Brisbane audiences.
So, as David says, Coup Fatal has its Australian premiere tomorrow night, Alain, and you're the director of this piece. What is it? What is Coup Fatal?
In the first place, it's a concert. You know, it's this beautiful mixture between European Baroque music and Congolese traditional music or folk music even. It's the meeting between those two worlds. And so in the first place, it's a concert. And I was engaged in this project in a very late stadium, you know, because first they have been working, but Serge will explain a little bit more about that, for a long time before the musical director of this project, Fabrizio Casol, with whom I worked together in previous projects, called me and said, you have to come and see this because it's too strong. And they're looking for somebody who can stage it. And that's when I arrived.
And what elements struck you about the show that Serge and others had already created? What was appealing to you to make you want to work with this piece?
Well, first of all, the music, because it's really, really beautiful. I have the impression, because I'm a maniac, I'm addicted to European Baroque music, but I think after hearing Kufatal, I can never hear some of the songs again in its original version.
Because how does the music work in Kufatal? I mean, are they kept as distinct worlds, the world of European Baroque and the world of Congolese folk and popular music?
Oh, no, it's really what they call in French métissage. It's a mixture of both. It's really, sometimes it's really difficult to point where it shifts from one to another. There is something very logic and very smooth about how one music goes into another one.
Serge Kakuji, was your idea to mix Baroque and Congolese music? Why? Why bring these two worlds together?
Thank you for the question. I can say in the beginning, when after my first study in Namur, in Belgium, when I'm back in Congo, I did some Baroque concert, and sometimes the audience after the show told me that it's the good music, but what is it? and for me, I would say when I would have the time to mix something, and I would be very happy. And after the Caves, the Royal Theatre in Belgium, asked me to do a concert a Baroque concert in Kinshasa. But the problem in Kinshasa, there aren't Baroque orchestra. And it's by there with Paul Kessels of Caves. We can try to find a way to have a traditional to mix in orchestra traditional Congolese instruments and others Baroque instruments like the flute. In the beginning, we have flute in Kufatal, but after the work, and it was something very natural to get only arias Baroque and to leave flutes and keep only a traditional instrument, a traditional Congolese instrument.
So it's your voice, you're the main countertenor singing these arias with a whole range of Congolese instruments playing with you.
Yes, for me, Congo, it's my blood, and the rumba or the folk music, it's my life. And for me, I say yes to put my voice around that universe, that way. For me, it was a very, I can say, a big dream for me in my life. But yes, in the beginning, when we start the project, sometimes we play, for example, 3 or 5 songs for the reaction. The public was, the audience were very excited to see the end for the project.
So where, growing up in the Congo, Serge, where did you first hear opera or first see opera?
My first time to hear opera, it was in television when I was 7 years. So I went on to my parents, and I was in television, and I see the first time. For me, it was something like, wow, the star, the real star in the heaven. I say, what is it? And I was feel something like I was understand all the singer sing, but it was in the language I can't explain now, because it was something very strange in the good way. And for me, it was, I can say, that passion met me, not me met that passion. And when it met me, I was, I can say, Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Alan, a big part of Kufatal is not just this extraordinary music, but the look, the visuals. What are the costumes? Where are they coming from? Explain those for me that are such a big part of this show.
Well, when I saw the concert, I knew I had to really respect it, because that was the main thing. You know, I didn't want to make a dance performance out of it. So I just watched carefully what was happening, and I kind of revealed some of the signs that I saw, and some of the histories that I heard. And one of the main histories is the history of the sapeurs, which is a sort of a dandy movement in Congo, which has a long history and different forms. But nowadays, all the musicians have to be sapeurs in one way or another.
So
they have to dress up.
Dress up in what sort of?
Well, it's very difficult to explain, because it's a kind of mixture of clothes that we would never dare to combine, and they do, and they look absolutely fabulous in it. You know.
So sharp suits and lots of color.
Yeah, mixture of ingredients that we would never dare to mix,
and lots of very high design, European design labels, which is almost a parody of European fashion. Almost,
but that's where the original idea of sapeurs is really very interesting, because it was a sort of a reaction in the 1920s. From the Congolese people against the colonizers. They wanted to make fun of them, or also imitate them by putting on clothes that refer to the way they were dressed. And they put it in a very strange combination, like saying, we can do better than you.
It's certainly amazing looking. It's clearly a really joyful show, a celebratory show. Is it also a political show?
Well, if you want, yes. For me, absolutely. But I didn't want to make it clear. You know, I think the signs that refer to the political situation in Congo are there, and if you want, you can see them, you can hear them. You know, you can analyze, for example, the music and see what is what are the words of some of the songs and how they can be references to the situation in Congo. But I didn't want to make it clear. It's in the first place a very joyful and very a very joyful show, and in my opinion, in that way, it is another form of rebellion. You know, to express a certain kind of lust of life, to rebel against the situation in which most of the people in Congo have to live in.
Mm. Serge, is it a joyful show for you to perform in?
Yes, this show, it's my life. It's my life, yes.
Have your family seen it yet?
Not yet. I think the next week in Kinshasa, my parents will come to see for the first time Kufatal.
It's very exciting. Thank you so much for joining me. Serge Kakuji, star of the show Kufatal, and the show's director, Alain Platel. Thank you also to David Bertholdt, who's artistic director of the Brisbane Festival, and all best for this year's festival, David. Kufatal opens tomorrow night, along with the rest of the festival. And I'll be there, Michael, but I'll have to let you know how it goes.
Well, it does sound like a marvellous thing, Kufatal. I was colouring in while you were doing that interview, and so I've got a sense of what a beautiful experience is in for people in Brisbane, and I've become calmly receptive.
I hope you're using lots of fantastic yellows and royal blues and reds to get that sapeur spirit in your colouring in.
I know. I'm just so blissed out by the whole thing. So you've got a big show tomorrow. You're going to be on air for 3 hours tomorrow.
Exactly, we are. Radio National is being kept alive by the Brisbane team tomorrow. We are going to be broadcasting live from the Writers Festival, because that just opened last night. I went and heard John Ronson give the opening address, a typically funny, smart talk from him. And it's the Writers Festival has started, and tomorrow we're broadcasting live from 2 to 5. It's a free public event. We'd love listeners to come and join us, or of course you can listen to us wherever you happen to be.
Where do we go
to Radio
National? Be part of it?
You go to the Maywa Green, which is just next. It's between the State Library and Goma at at South Brisbane in Brisbane. All the details are on the RN website at the Books and Arts page.
And who are some of the people in the show, Sarah?
I'll be speaking to Laurie Penny, who people might have seen on Q&A on Monday night. She's a young British feminist who talks a lot about politics and sexism, politics in the internet, and also two really interesting books from young male memoir writers. One, Oliver Moll. I've just read his debut work called Line Attack, which was fantastic, laugh out loud funny. He's going to be along, and there's going to be conversations Paul Barclay's leading on what drugs do to your brain. Might be worth listening to, given your colouring in interest now, Mark. And also a conversation about the surprising parallels between mateship and crime. Anthony Fennell from Future Tense is going to be leading that.
I don't know why you've implied to the nation I'm on drugs. I'm not on drugs. I'm on coloured pencils.
Just the way you're talking about blissed out colouring pencils. I think there might be some hallucinogenic factor involved in your colouring.
I don't know. I'm going to put them down right now. Now you've got me frightened. Sarah Kodosky, I'll be looking forward to hearing you tomorrow.
Thanks, Michael.
Sarah Kodosky with Books and Arts right through the afternoon from 2 to 5 here on RN. Next up, whatever became of the Book Council?
He throws a manila folder down on the desk. Across the top is wanted, and underneath a photo of a man and a woman. And he says, do these people live in the apartment next to mine?
The Moth. True stories told live. This week, your typical guy next door helps the FBI arrest his neighbour. America's most wanted criminal. For real. That's The Moth, Saturday nights at 7, right here on RN.
As a journalist, I was a frustrated politician. As a politician, I'm a frustrated journalist. And when I was a trainee priest for 3 years in my 20s, I was just frustrated.
Yeah, boom, boom. Prime Minister Tony Abbott in sharing mood at last year's Prime Minister's Literary Awards. And in that speech, he revealed his reading tastes. He likes Nikki Gemmel. And he reminded us that many prime ministers have written books. And he announced the formation of a book council. And he said that the council will promote good reading as well as good writing. Now, that was in December 2014. So getting on for a year has passed. What has happened? Well, an open letter to the Prime Minister and to the Minister of the Arts is asking exactly that. Where is our book council? There are 39 signatories, and they include publishers, literary agencies and festivals. And one of the organisations that signed is the literary journal Kill Your Darlings. Hannah Kent is the publishing director of Kill Your Darlings, and as I'm sure you know, she's also the author of the award-winning novel Burial Rites. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice to have you here. So there are 39 people from the book world or organisations from the book world who've signed this letter. What's the thrust of it?
Well, basically, I think we're excited about the Book Council. We're excited about the $6 million that has been promised, but 8 months have passed and we have not really any idea about who's going to be consulted, who's going to be funded and why and when it will all begin. So really, we're just hoping to get some answers and start a discussion about what we can do with all this money and with the council.
Yeah, well, $6 million was taken away from the Australia Council to fund this. And so I suppose the industry thought that it would be up and running by now. I mean, has there been any consultation as far as you know?
No, not as far as I know. And I think that's probably where some people's frustration is coming from. Most proactive inquiries into the policy and strategy of the council have largely been ignored. So I think that's really why people want to get this back on the table, so to speak. This is why we want to start working out, you know, will we be consulted? Who will be? Will there be opportunities for people to put forward ideas? There's really just not a lot of understanding about what is going to happen.
Now, Hannah, I was at the Prime Minister's Awards when the Prime Minister made that announcement. And to my amazement, there are all sorts of people in the room who had a very clear idea about what a book council was, as if there was already a template in the cosmos. I was quite astonished, really, because I had no idea what a book council would do. What's it for, do you think?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, as Prime Minister Tony Abbott said, it was to promote good reading and good writing, and they're talking about raising and strengthening the national and international profile of Australian arts, and that all sounds fantastic, but the questions of how and who exactly is going to do this and when is it still going to happen, those questions still all apply.
I mean, it sounds like a great idea to me to have at least some agency that's responsible for projecting a positive image of Australian intellectual effort and creative effort, because, you know, we project such a peculiar image of ourselves overseas as a bunch of, you know, ockers just out for a good time. So to have a more sophisticated image of Australia projected is a good idea. Now, I gather that there's going to be some sort of get-together. Is there? What's happening? Where's the chance for talking about this?
Well, this is really what the letter wants to instigate, I believe. You know, it might be something as simple as, you know, George Brandis setting aside a room in Canberra for us all to gather and, you know, put forward delegates and have a discussion. But so far, really, it's been the letter that's going around and more and more people are signing it as days go by.
I should say we contacted the Arts Ministry and they told us that the Book Council of Australia has been established in response to extensive consultation with the sector that commenced with the Book Industry Strategy Group in 2010. Mm-hmm. What's your response to that?
Well, that was 5 years ago. And I think there's discussion that still needs to happen. There's more consultation that still needs to happen. I think many of the people in the literary sector have not been consulted that perhaps should be. People such as festival directors, directors of writer centres, individuals, early career writers. It's a very broad sector and there's many people who could use these funds to, I guess, make their own contribution toward the Australian arts and the promotion of it overseas. So I would say that the consultation still needs to be ongoing and also perhaps it would be worthwhile for there to be some evidence-based research into where these funds are going to be most productive, where they're going to be most beneficial. I think the discussion needs to be ongoing. I don't think it's enough to say that there was extensive consultation with this sector. No one really knows who those people were way back in 2010. I think this needs to be an ongoing discussion, that there needs to be collaboration and also that there needs to be a certain amount of transparency in what's going on.
Well, I know that writers want to see results because this is $6 million that was taken away from the Australia Council that would otherwise, well, potentially have gone to writers. Now it's been reallocated more to the industry side of things. So you'd want to see some results, I guess. There is further statement from the government. They say that the Book Council of Australia will advise the Australian government, this goes to the purpose of it, will advise the Australian government on strategies to raise and strengthen the national and international profile of Australian writing, oh, that's what we were saying, and that membership will be drawn from a wide range of literary and industry organisations. Now, the Australian Society of Authors has a National Writers' Congress taking place next week, and I know that some politicians will be going to that, including the Arts Minister, George Brandis. So I guess that'll be a venue for some dialogue.
I hope so. I really hope so. I think that would be a wonderful opportunity for us to start getting some answers about where this money's going to go.
Well, Hannah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah Cairns, author and publishing director of the literary journal Kill Your Darlings. And the Minister's office tells us that Senator Brandis is happy to come on the program when further details are announced. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. What role do you see for a book council? Do we need one? You can tweet us. You can talk to us on our webpage. You can talk to us on Facebook. This is Books and Arts on RN. This very sprightly music is from the Perth-based new music ensemble Decibel. The piece is called Night Fragments. And this weekend, the group is bringing their music to the stage in a concert dedicated to the practice of animated notation. Now, the performers don't play from a traditional musical score. Instead, they take their cues from pictures or shapes or maybe even a beam of light. And these images will be on display to the audience at the concert they're giving. The concert's called Anime. Claire Nichols takes us inside one of Decibel's rehearsals.
I'm sitting in a lecturer's office at the WA Academy of Performing Arts, and it's pretty crowded in here. I'm squeezed into a seat beside a tired-looking piano, and around me a violist, a cellist, a bassist, a sound technician, and the composer Lindsay Vickery are crammed into whatever corners of the room they can find, rehearsing the new piece With the Fishes. Now, instead of sheet music, the players are all looking at their iPads, and it's not a traditional score they're looking at either. Instead, it's a series of pictures, quotes, and shapes. Yeah. a wild performance and really fascinating to watch. Just when you think there's no rhyme or reason to what the musicians are doing, they'll suddenly stop in unison, that bell sound will chime again, and a new phrase will begin. On the double bass is the leader of the ensemble, Cat Hope.
That was a piece in progress by Lindsay Vickery, who's one of the performers in Decibel as well, called With the Fishes. And it uses our Decibel Score Player, which is this iPad application we made to read graphic notation. So it's a series of composite images, which Lindsay's picked colours out of and inserted colours within and put traditional notation in as well.
It all sounds very confusing, but I'm sure it's going to make more sense as this chat goes on. And before we get into that, just watching you guys play, it wasn't like a traditional string concert. There were bows going up and down the strings instead of across the strings. At one point you were grappling and banging the double bass and I thought you might drop it on the floor. How left of centre is this type of music?
Well, we use a lot of extended techniques in our approach. So one of the great things about graphic notation, which is, I mean, the whole concert's around animated notation, which is this idea of music notation that's somehow in movement. And it's very rarely traditional notation, so the dots on the page. It's usually images and there's some traditional notation in Lindsay's piece, but it kind of enables a whole other language of sound, really, that's not restricted to pitches and rhythms and pulses, but actually a whole range of different textures. And sometimes to get those, you have to do things to your instrument you wouldn't normally do.
Okay, so we're talking about animated notation. In layman's terms, what is it?
Well, it's a relatively new trend, I'd say. It's usually created with and on computers. It uses colour and it uses aspects of what's called graphic notation, which is a practice of notating music with symbols, I'd say, rather than notes. So these can be drawings or blocks of colour. We've got some which are literally moving images as videos and other things which are lights drawing shapes onto the ground. So that's kind of what animated notation is. It's a movement which, I guess, takes graphic notation, which was quite popular in the 1950s, and pulls it into the digital realm, and which means it can be in motion, it can be interactive, it can use chance processes, so change each time you play it. There's a whole range of different opportunities that computers provide to notation that we're exploring in this concert.
What's so wrong with the normal music score?
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a normal music score, and Decibel actually play a lot of new normal music, but the theme for this concert is actually this kind of exploration of the potential of this as a notation for contemporary music.
The score could look like a series of colours, it could look like a series of shapes, it could look like a picture, perhaps. How do you then read that score?
Well, there's actually a lot of parameters in traditional notation that we apply to this imagery or this animated notation. And they're things like the higher up in the image it is, the higher up it is in pitch. The darker the colour, the more dense the sound is. These are things that actually as musicians we're trained in traditional notation to, you know, intuit almost. And so they become very important in graphic notation.
For this concert, Anime, you'll be showing the audience what these scores look like. What's that experience like for them?
Well, that's a good question because, I mean, personally as a composer, I don't like to share the notation. I did that very early on in my career and that's all that people seem to talk about, and like we're talking about right now. You know, what does it look like? I don't think we've really discussed how it sounds. So the idea of this concert, I guess, is to hold open, make it transparent, these processes that are going on, and enable the audience to make sense of it, see all these different tools that musicians use today that are usually behind the stand, I guess. I mean, we did it for the first time at a TEDx talk a couple of years ago, and we had an amazing response from people saying, you know, oh, now it makes sense, you know, those sounds, that's where they're coming from, it makes sense to me. So it's a really great opportunity, I guess, for the audience as well as the musicians to explore the potential of these alternative notations.
Now with us is Perth composer Jonathan Mustard. He's composed a special piece for the concert called Primorph, and instead of a series of notes on a staff, decibel players have been handed an animated video of moving three-dimensional shapes.
Well, I've taken as my basic idea just three very simple forms: a cube, a sphere, and a cone. And subjected them to a whole range of distortions over time that the performers have to follow. And I think even though we're starting with these primitive forms, they're in a constant state of morphology, if you like. So that's where the title of the piece comes from.
What does a cube sound like?
Well, it depends which instrument's playing it. I've got the clarinet and bass clarinet playing a cube, but I've also got a cello playing a cube. It doesn't really matter which instrument's playing which in a way, but it does add, you know, a difference from the audience perspective and from the performer's perspective as to, you know, which object to follow and which object they're relating to, which ones are interrelating to each other, and the difference in the way each one is changing over time.
What's the appeal of this kind of scoring for you?
We can have a direct correlation with something that is seen to something which is heard, and there's this organic connection between them, so that performers have to follow these using a number of the parameters of their instrument, etc., etc., in the way that Kat was explaining before. But I guess the other interest for me is that the sound of the piece is going to be quite different each time, although, you know, the overall form of the piece is going to be the same. The individual interpretation is going to be a little bit different each time. The performers only have a very short time to respond to what it is that they see on the screen. It's not like a scrolling score where you can kind of look ahead and see what's coming up. Because it's a video, they have to respond instantaneously.
That's very exciting to interpret works like this. Because it's like such a movable feast, like you so well described, it's like you're really in the moment and you can't see what's coming, you can't see what you just did. you're kind of intuiting and you can learn it. I mean, it's a fixed piece, so you can learn where the shapes are going to go and how they're going to change, so you can develop a series of approaches. But at the same time, you can never get it exactly. Yeah, you can never know exactly when things are going to happen. So it's very exciting for a performer to be involved in that process.
I'm asking performers to play faster than they can think.
Yep.
Music makers Kat Hope and Jonathan Mustard there with Claire Nichols, and the Decibel Concert Anime will be bringing its magic to the Perth Institute of Contemporary Arts, that's PICA, this Saturday, the 5th of September. It's a bit like colouring in, isn't it? Sort of colouring in with sound. Which brings me back to where we started with our story, that colouring in for adults is all the rage and that it helps people find some calm. Now, Graham's comment on our website, he says, what a crazy phenomenon. Get out and garden, take photos, read on the beach, learn to play an instrument, anything but reverting back to a child. I acknowledge maybe it has a psychological benefit, but there is nothing creative in it. So Graham's a sceptic. Elizabeth says that I was introduced to colouring in as part of treatment following a suicide attempt. I found colouring in meditative drawing helps me to cope with depression. So some mixed response there to that story. I'd love to know what you think. Keep the conversation going on our website, won't you? Thanks to the team. The executive producer is Rhiannon Brown. The producers are Georgia Moody, Kate Evans, Anna Frey Taylor, Claire Nichols and Anita Barrow. And our sound engineer today is Matthews Sigley. The news is next, and then Radio Tonic. And today, Jack Kerr investigates the claim that East German Olympic athletes were supplied with cosmic music to boost their performance. This is music known as Kraut Rock. So what's the theory? What's the music? What's the truth behind Krautrock? That's next on Radio Tonic. And don't forget that Books and Arts is with you for 3 hours Saturday afternoon, right through from 1 to 5, coming to you from the Brisbane Festival. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Have an excellent weekend. Bye-bye.